Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 13th of February, and it's all things political for this Monday. CPAC took place over the weekend. We will be talking about that. Mitt Romney had a win in the main caucus, although there is some controversy about that win. The president is coming to Milwaukee on Wednesday of this week to go to Master Lock, and he delivered, as you heard during the news from NPR, the massive budget to all members of Congress just within the last few minutes. We will talk about that and whatever else you'd like to discuss. Here's our phone number for all things political, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, that would be just fine. That's talk@wpr.org. We have two guests with us during the course of this hour. Professor Peverell Squire is chair in American Political Institutions at the University of Missouri. He got his PhD at Berkeley. He's senior editor of Legislative Studies Quarterly and co-chair of the International Political Science Association's Research Committee for Legislative Specialists. His research focuses primarily on American politics, with particular emphasis on legislative institutions and elections. He has taught American government, state politics, Congress and legislative policy, American political institutions, legislative institutions, and the evolution of American legislatures from 1619 to the present. Professor Squire, thanks very much for joining us this Monday.
My pleasure.
Also joining us from Maine today is Professor Jim Melcher, Associate Professor of Political Science. He teaches a number of different courses, including courses on the court, legal case studies and political realities, Congress and the presidency class. And he is known, he also teaches Intro to American Government, to Constitutional Law, Public Opinion, Interest Groups, and Parties. He said that he caught the political bug as a five-year-old boy in Madison, Wisconsin, where he became keenly aware of the Nixon-Humphrey presidential election in 1968. He is also known for humor in the classroom and does some fairly mean impersonations, I understand. Professor Melcher, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you. It's some wicked good to be here. I mean, yes, it's very nice to be with you this morning. If it's American politics and it's taught at UMF, I'm usually the guy doing it. Yep.
Thank you so much. It's amazing how many people on this show have Madison connections.
People from Madison tend to come from all over and then tend to fire off all over. My friends that went to Madison West with me have scattered thoroughly all over the country and around the world like we were balls in a pinball machine. So we're spreading the Badger love all around the country.
Oh, well, maybe you'll hear from some of them this morning. Let's start with Maine because you had caucuses. I guess there weren't too many people who showed up. There has been some concern, particularly on the part of Ron Paul, that some of the caucuses didn't happen because you had snow, but you didn't have all that much snow. What's the story here?
Yeah, and I think the Ron Paul people think that they've been the victim of a snow job. Our caucuses in Maine for Republicans go on over a pretty extended period of time. The first ones to go were in Unity, home of Unity College, were actually in the waning days of January, and then they were supposed to wrap up Saturday with a big announcement with the Republican bigwigs down in Portland. So they're scattered over a long period of days. One of our easternmost county in the state, in the country, in fact, Washington County, decided to cancel their caucus, which meets in only one location in a pretty far-flung, mostly rural county, when they thought there would be a bad snowstorm. We get pretty good snowstorms here in Maine, just like Wisconsin. And northern Hancock County next to it also postponed their caucuses to this Saturday. But the Maine Republican Party and its controversial chair, Charlie Webster, wanted to get the announcement out about how Maine had voted while it was scheduled, and the media were there, and announced that Washington and the northern part of Hancock County's results in the straw poll would not be included in their count. And the Paul people had good reason to think that those areas would be ones that they would do well in. They had the demographic characteristics and voting behavior that seemed to match where Ron Paul did do well. As far as turnout caucuses is, unless you're talking about Iowa, almost always quite tiny. But believe it or not, it was actually higher in Maine than it was in 2008 in the John McCain, Mitt Romney race. Now, when I say higher, it was under 6,000 people in the places that showed, but that's actually a little bit more than all the counties put together had in 2008. But it just goes to show you how in a caucus, a really small number of people can have a big impact.
Mm-hmm. So could we have another case similar to Iowa that a week from now we're going to hear, oh, Ron Paul actually won Maine?
It's entirely possible, though not as likely. I think Rick Santorum trailed in the initial count in Iowa by under 100 votes. Here, in a much smaller state with less turnout, he's down by closer to 200 votes. Hypothetically, it's possible. And the Ron Paul people, I think, are absolutely within their rights to say, this is jumping the gun. We still have a chance. Mathematically, unless they get an astonishing turnout, I think it's unlikely Paul would win. But sure, we could definitely have a replay of what happened in Iowa, and that would be, of course, Ron Paul's first state win.
Mm-hmm. And what does this tell us about the whole process? And I want you to give us some understanding of what in the world happened in Missouri. It was described as a meaningless beauty contest. Your caucus, will there be some other kind of caucus in Missouri, Professor Squire?
Well, we did have this sort of split process. The state legislature last year failed to get a bill through that would solidify the whole situation. So we had a non-binding primary last week, which got some attention simply because it happened on the same day as a couple of other events in Colorado and Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And then next month we will have caucuses, which will be organized initially at the county level. And we'll see whether very many people choose to participate in those, but those caucuses will actually determine the state's delegates.
Did Santorum campaign pretty heavily in Missouri, or how do you explain his win in all three states last week?
Well, he campaigned more heavily than anybody else in that he actually came to the state.
Oh.
It was a situation where nobody really thought much was going to be at stake in Missouri, so only Santorum bothered to show up. And because of that, he managed to probably generate more enthusiasm among Republicans than any of the other candidates.
And why do you do this non-binding primary and then a caucus?
Well, they did it simply because the state legislature last year passed a bill that got vetoed and then couldn't pass another bill to have it all happen on the same day in March. And so they decided on the Republican side that they didn't want to risk losing half their delegates, as Florida supposedly will, for holding their primary too early. So they couldn't change the date of the primary. They just made it into a non-binding event, and then they'll have their party caucuses a month later. It's a situation that leaves nobody happy in the
mm-hmm.
state.
So what do we make of what we've been through the last couple of weeks in the Republican caucuses and primaries? Are we still seeing an election that may go to the convention because there are a substantial number of conservatives who don't like Romney and would prefer Santorum? Or is it pretty much Romney's nomination? Where do you both see things going?
Well, if it does really become an open decision at the convention, it would be the first time in decades where that's happened. And it seems that people have recited scenarios where this will happen or that will happen, the Democrats in 2008 or the efforts by Ted Kennedy's forces to pry loose Carter delegates in 1980. And there's always way more talk of a truly open convention than seems to really, really play out. I would be surprised if it does turn out to be an open convention, even as Sarah Palin and a lot of other conservatives and the Republican Party aren't satisfied with Romney. It's difficult to see, for me, a path where any of the people challenging him right now would have enough support to be able to put up much of a fight.
Do you agree, Professor Squire?
Well, I think, again, it's probably unlikely that we'll have a nomination decided at the convention. We haven't had that since 1952. and the odds are generally stacked in favor of having a decision made during the primaries. But nothing has played out this year along the lines that most of us would have predicted. And I can see scenarios where certainly Romney gets a lot of delegates but doesn't have enough to secure a first ballot victory, in which case we would actually have the sort of event none of us can imagine happening again in American politics, where the convention could be decided in all kinds of different ways and all kinds of different directions.
With a candidate we haven't even thought of at this moment?
Well, that's a possibility, although it would be hard if, say, Santorum has lots of delegates just behind Romney, that one of those two wouldn't end up getting the nomination. But it also might depend on how they're polling relative to President Obama by the summer, and if it looks like both of them are losers, the Republicans might choose a wild card.
Mm. And what about the CPAC convention? Romney in a straw poll won that, but then Santorum said, well, he may have packed the hall.
Well, it's hard to. One of my students was down at CPAC and was very struck by how little effort on behalf of Ron Paul there was. Ron Paul had run very well at it 4 years ago. I think it's more a matter of a lot of the anti-Romney vote being essentially divided. I've seen some stories that suggested that some people were talking about Jeb Bush, the governor of Florida, as a potential candidate, and certainly Sarah Palin. Speech saying, we should unite behind whoever the Republican nominee is, but I'm really not convinced that that Mitt Romney is really a true conservative, I think in some ways speaks as loudly to how Romney is doing than the actual result of the CPAC straw poll.
Mm-hmm.
It appears from some of the news reports that Romney decided to invest some resources in the CPAC and did buy tickets into the convention for people who supported him, and this is something they had opted not to do with the Ames straw poll way back last summer, which seemed to give Michelle Bachmann a big boost. So I think Romney now understands he's in a very difficult fight, and he needs to secure support wherever there's a contest, and I think he's got the resources, unlike the other candidates, where he can do this in straw polls and in caucuses and in primary states.
And to reinforce what he said, that's exactly what he did in Maine. He came to Maine after almost all of our caucuses had finished, decided to have a last-minute visit to Portland to try and shore up some of his support. The places that went most heavily for Romney were the more prosperous suburbs of Portland. So that was something that didn't seem to be in their calendar all along. So I would agree with what Professor Squire has said about how I think Romney realizes that he's going to have to contest some places where perhaps they thought they could coast a little bit more a few weeks ago.
And let's pinpoint some of the reasons that Romney is having problems right now. Professor Squire?
Well, Romney certainly has been running for president for a long time now. You can probably calculate it at about 6 years. His record is based on his governorship in Massachusetts, which is a very liberal state, and where he was forced as governor into taking some fairly liberal positions, both when he ran for the governorship and earlier when he ran for the U.S. Senate. And a lot of those positions now are coming back to haunt him, and a lot of the ads that he's run and a lot of the bills that he had to sign. And so he's having to work very hard to convince conservatives that he's actually one of them when there's evidence to suggest that at different points in time he was less enthused about conservative positions. So at a time when the Republican Party's become very conservative in terms of the activists and the people participating in caucuses and primaries, it's a hard sell sometimes for Mitt Romney, given his record, to be as conservative as they would like.
Mm-hmm.
I would echo all of that and to say I think part of it also is not just a concern about his authenticity, but also a matter of his style. You know, he's got kind of more of an old-fashioned patrician Republican style, not entirely unlike George Herbert Walker Bush. A lot of the people who've become active in the Republican Party in the last few years through the Tea Party prefer somebody who's more pugnacious, like Governor Christie of New Jersey, like Sarah Palin. And he comes off as being somewhat out of touch. A lot of people picked on him when he came to Maine and was speaking at a yacht manufacturing company. Now, shipbuilding is very important in Maine. That might not have been the best visual for him. I think some people look at him a lot like the way people looked at John Kerry in 2004, that he seems sort of stiff, seems a little manufactured, doesn't seem to have that passion in the gut that I think a lot of Republicans in particular are looking for. You've got a million sound bites that, you know, the corporations are people, my friend, and the comments about the very poor. I think he hasn't come off well to everybody in terms of his personal style so far in the campaign.
Is he too rich, or does that not make a difference?
I think that, well, I mean, I don't think it's so much the money. I mean, I think it reinforces some of the idea that he has money. I mean, it's, again, more the things he's said. You know, I don't think, certainly in the Republican Party, people necessarily hold it against him that he's wealthy. But when he says things like, well, I made, you know, was it $380,000 in speaking fees, and that's not really a lot of money, it doesn't play well. You know, certainly, you know, rich candidates have done fine, and, you know, go back to Franklin Roosevelt. In both parties, I think it's more the way his wealth reinforces some of the perceptions that people have about him more than his money per se.
Mm-hmm. Professor Squire, I've been hearing different things from different states as to where he's gathering his support. Some states have said, well, he got it across the board. Others are saying it's those rich suburbs that Professor Melcher described that are the base of his support. Does he have a base? Is it pretty much across the board or not?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I suspect, at least here in Missouri, that Romney's support comes from Republicans who calculate that he's their best chance to beat President Obama. And I'm not sure there's much enthusiasm or passion about Romney the person, but more about Romney the potential winner. And I think as that gets punctured, as it makes it, you know, a more difficult case to make given surveys and his performance in some of the caucuses and primaries, that he loses some of that support, and people sometimes revert back to their issue preferences, which probably in the Republican Party in Missouri align more closely with Santorum or maybe Gingrich rather than Romney. So I think Romney really does need to have this image that he's the best candidate to go against the president in the fall. And to the extent that that's not as compelling a case as he would hope it would be, he's in for a much tougher primary campaign.
To your phone calls momentarily, we're talking about all things political this hour, and our guests are Professor Melcher, Associate Professor of Political Science and Pre-Law Advisor at the University of Maine, Farmington, and Professor Squire, Chair in American Political Institutions and Political Science at the University of Missouri, Senior Editor of the Legislative Studies Quarterly. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this Monday, we'll be talking with coaches and participants, student participants in the Wisconsin Academic Decathlon. Students from Wisconsin have done very, very well in this competition, and we will talk with all of them about this very interesting program, hour two of the show. Two phone calls now for our guests, all things political. 800-486-8655 is the number. Anita in Gurnee, Illinois. Hi, Anita.
Hi. I love this show. In Maine, Portland is not next door to Kennebunkport, Kennebunkport being the Bush stronghold, and they're very influential in that area. I would think that if we knew how Romney did in that area, it could be indicative of how much confidence some of the big boys in the Republican Party really have in Romney. How did he do in the Kennebunkport area?
Vote for Kennebunk, both in Kennebunk and Kennebunkport, which are separate towns about half an hour southwest of Portland, was extremely strong for Mitt Romney. Romney won Kennebunk 29-5, won Kennebunkport 56-17. Those are some of the biggest margins that Mitt Romney had anywhere, and they're very much reflective of the kind of old-fashioned moderate Republicanism, what people used to call silk stocking or country club Republicanism, did very well in those places and somewhat similar places like Cape Elizabeth, Yarmouth, and some of those others. We did really well in the Kennebunks.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much for the call. Who were the knockout speakers, gentlemen, at CPAC? Professor Squire?
Well, you know, I think it was a fairly low-key affair this time around, and I don't think anybody particularly wowed them. I think all three of the candidates who spoke acquitted themselves reasonably well, but again, I think probably the one phrase that's going to come out of CPAC that will be with us for the rest of the campaign is Romney's claim that he was severely conservative, which was an odd choice of words and
right.
Something I'm sure the Obama campaign is trying to think of how best to make use of them.
Yeah, what in the world did he mean by that, severely conservative?
Well, I think he wanted to say that his record, of course, was more conservative than people give him credit and that he was facing a very liberal state legislature and he was able to push them in the direction he wanted to go. But again, nobody's going to sort of probe that depth of examination of his record. And instead, they're going to wonder what he means by some of the phrases he uses. And again, this is another one that probably doesn't convey what he hoped it would.
Mm-hmm. Professor Melcher?
No, I really can't add anything to that. I think that's true. And again, he's got some of that kind of gaffe-prone way about him. For somebody who seems as polished as he does, for somebody who has as much experience in the limelight, with somebody who's got really an incredibly strong resume for being president, you know, the Olympics work, all his years of activism in the Republican Party, as being a candidate before, as having been governor of Massachusetts, the Salt Lake City Olympics. For somebody who you would think would be very versed in how to deal with the media, sometimes the things he says don't seem to come off well. And again, I think a lot of the reservation people in his party have is about the sincerity of the conversion on things like abortion, on gay rights. Newt Gingrich in particular has hit him very hard on those sorts of things. And I think Professor Squire's right that aside from the ideological support, because where else is a moderate Republican going to go right now in the Republican Party, a lot of it is this sense of he gives us the best chance to beat Obama. Though, interestingly, Ron Paul's run about as well or even a little better in some matchup polls than Mitt Romney has against Barack Obama.
Let's talk about the president for a little while. Today, the budget was delivered to all members of Congress. Are we into yet another year of debate about the deficit?
I think that's probably inevitable, although neither party really wants to offer this very serious and painful set of choices that confront us as their policy alternatives. I think we'll even see the Republicans backing away from some of the Ryan measures that he talked about last year. I think both parties are just hoping at this point to get to the election and come out on the winning side and then try to get serious about policy debates then in 2013. But for right now, I think the president probably puts his best foot forward. I think his budget doesn't do a lot of the things Republicans would like, but probably tests well in terms of focus groups, and I think he'll probably be able to counter a lot of the Republican criticisms reasonably well.
Mm-hmm. One of the themes we've been hearing from many of the Republican candidates is religious freedom. The president ran into a bit of a snafu with the whole birth control issue and had a few bishops upset with him. Tell me about that issue. Is that something that makes Catholics mad, or is it just the bishops mad? And did he do the right thing in reversing course, Professor Melcher?
Well, I mean, it depends on which Catholics you're talking about. Certainly the bishops continue to be angry with him, and they had initially said, our bishop here in Maine had said, well, that's a good first step, but we'd like to see more. And in the last 24 to 48 hours, the bishops have said, no, we don't find this satisfactory. The Republican Party has had a lot more to say from congressional leadership this weekend about that issue than about the budget. It seems like it's a good example of both parties trying to play to their bases. I think the president handled the issue relatively well. I think he probably looked like he was turning his back on some promises that he had made some of the people in the Catholic Health Association that he'd turned to. And I think where things might have hurt him more is out of a perception of, well, does he tell the truth? Certainly Archbishop Dolan in New York had tried to say, well, this is part of a broader pattern that the president's promised things that he hasn't delivered on. And I think in his move, the way that he handled it, I think he moved enough toward trying to protect access to birth control to keep his base happy, but far enough over that the people who would find any compromise on his part satisfactory will be satisfied. But rank-and-file Catholics don't necessarily follow everything the church does. The correlates in public opinion have a lot to do with how often people go. You know, there's a lot of, we see them at our Episcopal church, too, a lot of sort of Christmas and Easter right. Catholics that aren't necessarily there all the time, and those don't tend to follow the teachings of the bishops on those issues as well. So I don't think you can look at Catholic voters as such as a completely monolithic group on it. I think the bigger issue is, does he seem to mean what he says? Does he seem to be consistent? But I think the issues in terms of how it will play out as an electoral issue is just going to be one of those kind of issues that just reinforces people on both the right and the left. It's brought together all of the president's conservative opponents. You know, Newt Gingrich has been talking a long time about how he thinks that the president is leading a secular war against organized religion, the Catholic Church in general, and pro-choice groups and pro-contraception groups are saying, well, just look at how awful those Republicans are. So I don't think it as much changes a lot of people's mind on things as much as it just reinforces people where they're at already, particularly after the president's movement toward compromise this last week.
Professor Squire, what do you think?
My guess is this is an issue that we probably won't be talking about in a few weeks. I think this is probably an inside-the-beltway sort of elite issue. You can get, as Professor Melcher suggests, activists on both sides worked up on this issue. My guess is it probably doesn't resonate a great deal with most Americans. They're more concerned with direct issues in terms of the economy and where the world's going to be in a few months and a few years rather than this particular issue. And so I suspect as we see more survey results come out, and we don't have very much to work with right now, but as we sort of test what people think about this particular issue, it probably won't have the traction. Certainly the Republicans think it does, and I suspect even Democrats won't see that they're able to really turn it to their great advantage either.
Dan in Grant County, our next caller. Hi, Dan.
Hi. My question is, you see what's gone on in the world the last few years, whether it is the Enrons, the banking and investment community, and you see all these people, what started this deal that all things government are bad? It just blows my mind. I know there are good people in government and there are good people in industry. What has turned the country so far? It's like they hate anyone. If someone says they're a public employee, it's like they're, you know, some kind of devil. What's happened?
I think it's a culmination of a process that's been going on for a long time, and some of it really, I think, goes back to Ronald Reagan and the more conservative movement in the Republican Party in the early 80s. You know, Ronald Reagan very famously said, government is not the solution, government is the problem. And I think the Republican Party in particular has picked up on that theme over the years where, you know, you think of, say, in Wisconsin, the kind of policies of Governor Knowles Bowles had, or even for that matter, Tommy Thompson had, really didn't necessarily see government as being evil, being a bit of a being so much of a problem. But I think a lot of it also has come out of the economic downturn, that people are looking for folks to blame. They say, well, I've had to cut my budget. I want to see those people do it also. And conservative folks and the Koch brothers and the others with money have helped heighten that. And a lot of that's a lot of what's driving the Ron Paul support. Is Ron Paul is very skeptical of government in all manner of guises. And I think he's given a lot of voice to people who feel that way about those issues. But I don't think it's just in the last couple years. I think that's been brewing since really the early 1980s.
Hmm. Professor Squire.
It's almost to me like people, they don't like their country almost. It's almost that severe. And that to me is very bothersome. I mean, we used to say in the 60s, you know, America, love it or leave it.
Yeah.
I could say right now, well, if you don't like, you know, our government and anything that's going on here, go to Somalia. They don't fix roads. They don't do stuff. Go there if you don't want any taxes.
Professor Squire.
Well, it's certainly true. We've always had this strain of anti-government feeling. You know, you can look at the opposition to the New Deal under Franklin Roosevelt. You go back in the 19th century. There has always been this anti-government attitude among some portion of the population. I think Professor Meltzer's right. The current strain we have really is rooted in the Reagan Revolution in the 1980s. It's come to fruition now. There is more passion surrounding it. Certainly in Wisconsin, you've experienced probably some of the worst of the anti-government feeling, people just pushing it as far as they can. And what usually happens in American politics when we tend to drift too far in one direction is there is a backlash, and we tend to draw things back towards the center where most Americans still reside in terms of their politics. And so I think we will see a clash over the next couple of months, certainly in Wisconsin. If you have the recall elections, you're probably going to face it before anybody else. But we're going to have a serious, long conversation about the role of government and exactly what we expect from government, and we'll find out that there are more people who do, in fact, understand that government provides a lot of benefits, a lot of protections, and so there will be resistance to this desire to try to minimize government to the extent some people are pushing.
Thanks, Dan, for your interesting call. Tim in Elm Grove.
Really.
Hi.
Different about the Tim, modern flavor. Is there so much more against public employees and unions as
yes.
part of it that's different from the 1980s? I think is a new twist that we've seen in the last few years.
Yeah. Tim, go ahead.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Tim.
Good morning. A comment I wanted to make is relative to this difference of opinion regarding the contraception, et cetera. And I guess I'd like to challenge a lot of the and I'm a lifelong Catholic. I'd like to challenge a lot of the Catholics who are making that exception or are so frustrated or angry. Where were you when the government was funding executions and wars that Pope John Paul and said were not a good idea? John Paul was very vocal with George Bush about the Iraq war. So your tax dollars went to that. Where were you then? And I will flip the coin over and challenge those folks and say, candidly, you're cafeteria Catholics.
Any of you want to respond? Thanks, Tim, for your call.
How? It's a number of issues. I mean, there's been a lot of statement about economic justice from the Catholic Church also. But I think a lot of it has been the extent to which the bishops have emphasized those kind of issues. You had the issue up in La Crosse when John Kerry was campaigning for president saying, I'm not going to give him communion if he seeks communion right. in my church. So I think part of it has been how the American bishops have emphasized abortion and sexuality issues, perhaps even more than the previous pope and the current pope have. So I think some of that's traceable to the leadership and the things that they're hearing in their own churches, and not just the laity going against what they're being taught.
Dick in Oak Creek. Hi, Dick.
Hi there. I have to make one comment about the bishops, and I want to ask you my original question. I wish these bishops would worry about their child molesting priests instead of worrying about birth control. But my question, here's my scenario. We know that the most Republicans don't like Romney, and they think he's a rhino. And I think if they have a deadlock convention, Sarah Palin comes running in on a white horse and wants to be the nominee. What do you think? Are the possibilities of that happening? I certainly hope it does, because I think she'd be the weakest candidate.
Professor Swire.
My guess is that the convention, if they were to look for another candidate, probably wouldn't turn to Sarah Palin. She certainly still has supporters in the Republican Party, but I think she's probably forfeited a lot of her standing by resigning and some of the things that she's done since she's resigned. I think she's more of a personality now than a political leader. I suspect if they were to turn to somebody else, as Professor Melcher suggested, Jeb Bush might be a possibility. Mitch Daniels in Indiana would be another candidate that I think most Republicans could rally around. This is all sort of far-fetched scenarios. I think we'll probably will have a winner come out of the primary season, but again, that's probably less certain now than at any time in recent political history.
Thanks, Dick, for the call. Pat in Oshkosh, hi.
Kathleen, I just tuned in real late, and I heard you talking about taxes. Last night I had the fortune of finally seeing Bill Moyers' new show, Moyers and Company, on public television, and he had a gentleman by the name of Bruce Bartlett on, who's an economist, served in, I think, the first George Bush's cabinet, and has written a couple of scathing books regarding the Republicans or the conservative, the neocon approach to taxation. And one of the points I wanted to make was that he made was correspondence between taxes and freedom, the relationship that if someone was taxed at, say, a 25% rate, well, then in their minds, they're only 75% free. And this movement to try and cut taxes down to nothing is the only true way to find 100% freedom. That was interesting.
Whoever wants to take this, thanks, Pat, for your call. You don't have to.
Sounds very reminiscent of how people talk about tax day. You know, how you're working for the government up until whatever it is this year, May 10 or whatever. So that's certainly a theme people have developed over time. I think people who are advocates for government action, frankly, have taken for granted that people will see what government accomplishes. And I don't think that that's really a safe assumption anymore.
Well, I suspect, again, I think both parties are going to have to touch on some of these issues. And as we look at them at the national level, and we have this large deficit, and we look at what the possibilities are to try to get closer to a balanced budget again, the only rational solution either party will be able to come up with is to raise revenue and to cut programs. There's just no way of doing it simply by emphasizing cuts or simply emphasizing taxes. And I think most of the sort of journals will get to that place. You look at the Wall Street Journal today, they note that if you cut all discretionary spending, we still have a $700 billion deficit this year for the federal government. So I think most people just have to become a little better educated about what's in the budget and where the money goes and what the real plausible scenarios are for trying to deal with the budget deficits.
But with so many Republicans who've taken Grover Norquist's no taxes pledge, that's going to be hard for a lot of Republicans to have the flexibility to look for more revenue. I mean, they all remember what happened to George Herbert Walker Bush's, read my lips, no new taxes. And I think theoretically that sounds good, but I think a lot of Republicans have put themselves in a corner where raising revenue is going to be extremely difficult for them to be able to carry off and not have their base turn on them.
Well, I think that's a reasonable concern, and certainly Grover Norquist has tried to convince people of that. But I think, again,
As you confront the reality, as you have to make the budget cuts that are actually demanded if you don't raise more revenue, they're going to find that they're going to run into significant resistance on that score, too. So, you know, we may have another series of muddle-through budgets and situations where we just hope we grow our way out of at least some of the problem. But I think, again, as you actually confront the numbers, and as people push to confront those numbers, it becomes less tenable for either party to hold to their strictest preferences.
More phone calls in a moment. You're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guests are from Maine and Missouri, purposely selected because Maine had a caucus over the weekend and Missouri had, I don't know what exactly you call it, kind of a primary that was didn't mean anything. They will have caucuses down the road here, but we're looking at where the race stands and, of course, a lot of other news. The president is coming to Milwaukee on Wednesday. I want to ask our guests about the jobs that are coming back from China, if indeed Master Lock is just an anomaly or if this is happening to many industries in this country. So we'll discuss that. And we have one phone line open if you'd like to join the conversation. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Hour two of our program today. You'll be inspired by the young people and coaches who are joining us. They are part of Wisconsin Academic Decathlon. That's hour two of our show. President is coming to Milwaukee, gentlemen, on Wednesday of this week to Master Lock, located a few blocks from where our studios are. He highlighted this company in the State of the Union address and talked about the jobs that they have brought back from China. Is this a growing thing in the country? Lots of places bringing jobs back from China?
Certainly not. I'm not an economic expert, but I think that was a very carefully chosen example. I think the differences in labor costs and environmental regulation are still large enough that I don't know that that's going to be a major source of turnaround. Certainly it isn't something we've seen here in Maine. Right up the road from us, we used to have the largest toothpick factory in the world. That moved to China maybe 2 years ago for its production. There are certainly ways to work with China, educational exchanges and other sorts of things, but from my limited vantage point, I think Master Lock, though a very welcome exception, really isn't something we're seeing that much of around the country.
Professor Squire, are we seeing the economy pick up substantially, a little bit, too early to tell?
Well, it's certainly moving in the right direction. It has picked up some. Certainly in Missouri, the unemployment rate has come down. There is investment. We've had some investment from China. So some new plants opening up, some plants reopening up. I think there's a bit more optimism than there was. There's certainly a long way to go. A lot of people are still financially strapped. Nobody's feeling particularly good about things, but they're feeling a little bit better than they were a few months ago. And so I think as we try to forecast what the economy looks like in the fall and how voters are going to feel at that point in time, I think both parties have some reason to be nervous. The Democrats certainly want to see this pickup continue and sort of continue to work in their favor. And the Republicans are probably banking on the fact that the economy may still be in the doldrums, and that might give them an advantage. But at this point, it's not clear exactly how things are going to look a few months from now.
Jim in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I'd like to talk a little bit about the Catholic Church issue. I was Catholic most of my life. I'm 72, but I've been Episcopalian for 3 years. I'd refer people to look at the article by the ACL and you in Chicago Tribune editorial page today. And I left the Catholic Church for many reasons. One is the discrimination against women and married people in terms of the clergy. Dolan, it seems to me, Uncle Tom down the war, along with a lot of other people in the church. And there's some hypocrisy. A divorced person in the Catholic Church might have problems receiving the sacraments, but a sleaze like Newt Gingrich can receive sacraments, and the whole thing that I don't want to be mean to Catholics listening, but I wonder why you stay, because it seems to me the church is out of touch. They cultivate Elmer Fuddites, people who don't realize that the train has left the station in terms of the church, and it just makes me wonder why you stay in the first place to put up with all the abuse that you get.
And what about the president's stand on the birth control issue? Did he flip-flop? Was it okay with you what he did to make this political?
I think the main nuance here is that Catholics can make up their own mind whether they want to practice birth control or not, but the government provides a lot of funds for the hospitals and research and Medicaid and Medicare money, and I don't think we should be imposing our views on contraception, or they shouldn't be imposing their views on contraception on employees. That's their business, what they do with their life, and I think they're breaking the barrier between religion and government.
All right. Gentlemen, we've covered this. Does anybody want to respond again? It seems to be a hot button this morning.
Well, there's been a lot of movement between the Catholic and Episcopal churches over time, and politics has driven some of that. There have been people who've left the Episcopal Church and become Catholic, in part because they're more comfortable with the more conservative teachings of the Catholic Church on some of these social issues, and others have gone the other way. So politics and religion do get mixed in on a lot of it, and that's a common path of change for a lot of people, to put their church preferences in line with where they see themselves politically.
When the Republicans, Professor Squire, are talking about the government usurping religious freedom or a war on religion, who are they appealing to? This is obviously thought out.
Well, I think they're hoping that they will certainly tap into a lot of the anti-government strain that's out there. This is particularly virulent in the Republican Party on the more activist side. And so I think they're using this as a way to incite their activists to try to and make them more enthusiastic, more passionate about the campaign than they might be at the moment. I think, however, you'll notice that they're trying to frame it very carefully, that this is a question about religious liberty and not a question about contraceptives and their availability.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Republicans will probably run into some backlash as people look at this in a different way than they would like to have them look at it. I'm not even sure if it's going to work particularly well as a religious freedom issue, but certainly it's, for the last week or so, been an issue that they've been able to seize on, try to, again, divert some attention away from issues they would rather not talk about onto an issue that they would like to frame in a particular way that
right.
they think works for them.
Kate,
that's mostly true, but Rick Santorum has been pretty explicit in taking on, and I can't remember a presidential candidate that's taken on contraception and family,
yes,
and the purposes
right.
of sex and marriage as much as he has. I think most Republicans would rather stay away from that, but I think Santorum's had a really strong appeal to a certain core of voters, that he really is bringing up some of those kind of issues in a really explicit way, and I think that's a lot of his selling point to the people who back him.
Hmm. Kate in South Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I was prompted to call by the gentleman who made the comments about the anti-government feeling. And I worked for the federal government for 27 years. I worked for Internal Revenue Service, which was a party stopper. But when I worked for them, I was a senior tax specialist. And it was interesting to hear people who would call and be critical of the IRS, but then at the same time would want help with their taxes. And what I found is that people want to be critical of the government until they need the help. And as soon as services were cut, they are screaming. And at the same time, they'd be talking about how much the government, took in taxes and how we didn't need as much government. But when they needed services, that's when, we became important to them. And it was just an interesting way to observe people working from within.
Public opinion for years has shown that the public is much more likely to say, we think government spends too much, does too much, is involved in things when they're asked about it in an abstract way. When you start getting down to cases on most issues. People say, well, no, I don't want to cut that. I don't want to cut education. I don't want to cut roads. They will tend to say they would like to cut things like welfare, but there's a real disconnect between a lot of people's attitude about how much government they think they want and what programs they want to see protected. And that's gone on for a long, long time. And I think your experience in the IRS is a great illustration of that kind of dichotomy that people have in their head and don't always resolve real well.
Oh, I had a priest call once who was asking about his exclusion of certain types of income. And at the end of the call, he asked me, how can you work for the IRS? He said, don't you want to do something more helpful? And I said, well, this is my mission. I'm helping you right now.
And you could have told him that Jesus sat down with tax collectors, too. So if Jesus could do it, I don't see any reason why you can't.
Thank you, Kate. Thanks very much for the call. Thank you both for being with us this hour. I enjoyed the lively discussion. Thanks.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Our guest this hour, Professor James Melcher, Associate Professor of Political Science, Pre-Law Advisor at the University of Maine, Farmingham, grew up in Madison, Wisconsin, and Professor Peverell Squire, Chair in American Political Institutions and Political Science at the University of Missouri and Senior Editor of the Legislative Studies Quarterly. For those of you who may have just discovered us, we do this program every Monday at 9 o'clock. We, in the middle of a big presidential year, are covering all of the caucuses and the primaries quite carefully and getting your response to what's going on in the world of politics. So, next Monday again, 9 o'clock, same place. Different discussion, but same theme. News is coming up from NPR, and we'll return with another hour of Monday morning conversation.